Why do you stand far off, O Lord?
Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? In pride, the wicked hotly pursue the afflicted. Let them be caught in the plots which they've devised. For the wicked boasts of his heart's desire, and the greedy man curses and spurns the Lord. The wicked, in the haughtiness of his countenance, does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God. His ways prosper at all times. Your judgments are on high, out of his sight. As for all his adversaries, he snorts at them. He says to himself, I will not be moved. Throughout all generations, I will not be in adversity. His mouth is full of curses and deceit and oppression. Under his tongue is mischief and wickedness. He sits in the lurking places of the villages. In the hiding places, he kills the innocent. His eyes stealthily watch for the unfortunate. He lurks in a hiding place as a lion in his lair. He lurks to catch the afflicted. He catches the afflicted when he draws them into his net. He crouches, he bows down, and the unfortunate fall by his mighty ones. He says to himself, God has forgotten. He has hidden his face. He will never see it. That's the first 11 verses of Psalm 10. And it provides an interesting backdrop to the conversation of violence that I've been wanting to have for 3 weeks now. Tracy's getting tired of me coming home and telling her, I got a new idea about how to go about this violence sermon. I keep reworking this and refixing it. I was touched like everyone else was when we heard about all of these shootings, some of them in schools, some of them in public areas. And I say all of these shootings. Seems like there's a new one every week or more than one. I don't know if they're actually getting more common these days, but it certainly feels like they are. And we are exposed more and more to a culture of violence in our society. And I'm going to try to demonstrate over the next few weeks that this is simply one symptom of a society that has abandoned God. We could blame shift all day long. And if you watch the news or if you follow social media, that's what you've been watching people do. Maybe that's what you've been doing. It's the gun lobby's fault, or it's Congress's fault, or it's fault of our medical establishment. It's a bad parenting. It's bad economy. It's bad culture. It's video games. It's on and on and on we can go. There's always a different straw man to beat up. And I'm not suggesting those are necessarily bad arguments to make. I'm not here to suggest to you this morning that if you do this measure or that measure, it will help or it won't help. That's not my consideration today. I want to dig a little deeper than that. I want to dig down to the core and suggest to you what God has always offered in the Bible. We read about it in Romans chapter 1 a few moments ago. We read it in Psalm 10 here. A culture that rejects God, a culture that pushes back against the notion of God, against the notion of consequences, against the notion of sin, will inevitably drift to sin in general and to violence in particular. This is not an aberrant situation. This is predictable. This is understandable. This is unavoidable, I would argue. It may take a culture 10 years or 20 years or 50 years. But if a culture rejects God, a culture will grow to kill itself. And it takes any number of different forms. What I want to do is talk a little bit today about how this godlessness impacts the world with regard to violence. And I'll give you a few examples of this. And this is not just to say, look how horrible things are in the United States in 2019. That would be time poorly spent, I think. Our time here is intended to draw us closer to God. Now, we can't do a whole lot about our culture this morning, but perhaps what we can do is make ourselves a little bit more aware of where we are and how we got here, so that we can arm ourselves against this personally, in our individual lives, in our families, and in the church, so that we can be more equipped to stave this off, so that we can avoid the immediate ramifications of a violence culture in our own lives. Perhaps even have a ripple effect on others on the outside. In the absence of God, violence becomes justice. In fact, there is a very popular series of comic books that I grew up following. Once upon a time, there was Superman, and there was Batman, and there was Wonder Woman, and there was Aquaman, and there were various others that drifted in and out. And because these comic book heroes were popular, the comic book people decided to put them all together and come up with a new comic book where they would kind of team up and be this force for goodness in the world and all that kind of thing. And they called them the Justice League. The implication is that this organization pursues justice. Well, that sounds good. I mean, who wouldn't want justice? The problem is when violence becomes the tool by which we achieve justice. And in speaking of comic books, I don't want to get too deep into the woods here. I don't really read comic books all that much. I don't watch a whole lot of comic book stuff on TV or whatever. But it does occur to me, what I have seen over the last 10 years or so, that comic book stories have gotten extraordinarily violent. I'm not sure they're that much worse than other stories, but the days that I grew up with, the days of Biff and Bam and Sock, comic book violence with Adam West and his crew, that's not what you see on TV anymore. Nowadays, the more gruesome, the better. And this violence is seen as the way that things get done. The whole reason that we have vigilantes, the whole reason that we have superheroes, the whole reason that we have Dirty Harry or whatever other kind of anti-hero you may want to talk about, is that the job is not getting done. Government is supposed to be doing this, and we have grown to despise government. We've grown to distrust government. We've grown to loathe government. And I'm not saying government hadn't given us cause over the years. But what we read in the Bible is that government is the chosen tool in the hand of God to administer justice on a macro level. Perhaps in some situations, desert island somewhere, whatever, human society is too unevolved for government when they just kind of make it up as they go along. But as long as society has existed, and certainly as long as American society has existed, there have been rules in place. There have been laws. There have been people who are appointed or elected or who inherited the job who administer these laws. And the assumption is not only that government is going to administer justice, but also in a biblical context, that God is going to administer justice through government. Not perfectly. Nothing God does through the hands of men is ever going to be done perfectly. Not because of God's problems, because of our problems. But nevertheless, done in some form or fashion. Such was the case all the way back in the days of Rome. Rome was not known worldwide for its justice. That's not the defining characteristic of the Roman Empire. I'm not saying they were worse than other nations of the time. They weren't necessarily any better. And Paul says of government in that culture that our role as Christians in the midst of this culture is to submit to government, to accept the rule that government has over our lives, and allow government to do what God has placed it in place to do, even when it doesn't necessarily do the job very well. This is one of the great advantages that we have as people of faith. We can believe in the power of God even when we do not particularly believe in the power of government. Or we believe that the power of government is being administered in a poor way. We elected a knucklehead into Congress or into the presidency or governorship or whatever it happened to be. Or a criminal, as far as that goes. Many of these people in place have no intention of administering justice. Maybe they're trying to work backroom deals to avoid justice. And if you read the right blogs, you'll certainly get plenty of stories along those lines. Even in this culture, even when government is not necessarily measuring up to God's standards, we can act in faith and trust that God is going to have His way in the world. It may or may not work out to your satisfaction or to mine. But we can have confidence nevertheless that there is a plan in place and that we can trust God to work these things out. Now see, if you don't believe in God, if you don't believe in God's justice, then government stands or falls on its own. And now you have a whole different story, don't you? Now it's not a matter of whether or not to submit to government. Now we're having a discussion about how good government is. And there is a considerable difference of opinion on that. And if you lose faith in government and you don't have anything else to fall back on, all of a sudden, well, now what are we going to do? Justice is being denied us. And so you get vigilantism. You get riots. You get social unrest at large. This is why people do these things. This is why they riot. This is why they take the law into their own hands. Because the law isn't working. And you know what? They may be right. I have no doubt that in many situations they are right. Maybe not every situation, but a lot of them. Again, government is made up of human beings. Human beings are imperfect. Human beings let you down. Government will let you down. For people of faith, that's not the end of the story. People of faith can have confidence that God will work His way anyway, whether we see it or not, and we can therefore back off of the whole results-oriented view of the world, and we can live our lives in faith, believing that whether we see it or not, God will affect His changes, affect His will in the world. A culture that denies God in this context does not have that faith, does not have that confidence, and therefore you see cities burning. You see one ethnic group pitted against another. You see protests and screaming and ugliness and name-calling. Heads on pikes. Figuratively so far in our country, but I'm not dead yet. We may get there before I die yet. We need to understand, and we as people of God hopefully do understand, that if and when government fails, that does not mean that God has failed. It means people have failed. That doesn't surprise us, does it? People failed. Well, welcome to Earth. That doesn't mean it's okay for me to sin. Now, this is one of the advantages of not believing in God. You get to do whatever you want to do. And especially if government seems incompetent, well, you know, maybe I can do what I want to do and it's against the law and the government isn't going to catch me. And so therefore I can roam the streets with a hockey stick or a AK-47 or whatever it is they're shooting these days. And I can affect my own vengeance and I can affect my own justice in the world as I may define it. Be the Lone Ranger. You can do that. But again, we as people of God, not only can we not go down that road, we feel no need to go down that road. Because we believe that the situation is already in God's hands. So therefore, we manage our expectations. We do not expect great things out of government. I would encourage you not necessarily to expect anything out of government. Just live your life and submit to government. Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 8 and 9 talks about bureaucrats. You know, that one government official looks over another government official. If they're not down there with their hands in the dirt, I mean, in a literal sense, there are plenty of government officials down there with their hands in the dirt in
moral sense, but maybe not in a literal sense. The one is a blessing to the land if he's close to the lamb. But in the meantime, most of them are just kind of watching over each other. You know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more. We're not happy about that. And in our country, we have something to say about that. And I have no problem with saying something about it. Not in this form, but in other forms. Don't believe, though, that the solution is going to be come up with a better government. That's not going to be the solution. Because as long as it's in the hands of human beings will let you down. What you need to do instead is trust in God. And believe that God is working all these things out. And submit to human institutions. That's what the text says twice, actually, in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13 through 17. Honor the king. This is a king who, by some accounts anyway, was trying to kill Christians. Not everybody is united on that. But Nero did not have a stellar reputation for honesty and integrity and fairness. And just because you were a Christian, that didn't get you any special credit at all in Nero's court. That's fair to say. The Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter ultimately will both die at the order of Nero. And yet Peter says, and Paul says, submit to government. Honor the king. Well, what if he doesn't deserve any honor? Well, he deserves honor because God says he deserves honor. And I've been guilty of this. You know, I defend the president that I like and I make jokes about the president that I don't like. That's probably not fair. I don't want to get too judgmental about that kind of thing. But let's be cautious about how our attitude gets with regard to people who God has put in place to administer his will, even if they do not necessarily meet up with our standards or appear to meet up with God's standards. God calls us to faith. God calls us to believe in something bigger than government, something bigger than our own perception of justice. For us to walk by faith, not by sight. And that is a very easy thing to preach about, and that is a very difficult thing to do. When our sight is telling us that the train is off the rails, when our sight is telling us that the system is broken, that nobody is watching, just like we read about in Psalm 10, you're saying stick with a plan that is manifestly a disaster. Yes, I am. But I deny that it's a disaster. My affirmation is, and I base this on the Bible, that we are in the hands of God. And being in the hands of God does not always mean it's going to go well. It does not always mean it's going to go well for his people. It's not even always going to go well for his people when they do what they're supposed to do. But it will go well in the big picture. God will be glorified in the big picture if we walk by faith. If we will trust in him and go where he tells us to go and encourage as many of our neighbors to do so as possible, it would be better for us in the long term than it would otherwise. It may or may not change things in the short term. That's the frustration here. That's where faith comes in. If everybody going to church on Sunday meant that crime would end on Monday, everybody go to church. We could get that done. That would be a plan that would work. It's not going to work that way. You're not going to see short-term results. You may never see results. It may get worse instead of better. But faith gets us through these things. Faith helps us persevere. Faith gives us confidence that God will work things out in his way, in his time. Maybe not in your way. Maybe not in your time. Or even in your lifetime. To your satisfaction. But we, as people of faith, can have confidence that we can, in fact, do as Paul says in Philippians 4, verse 13, do all things through him who strengthens us. No matter what may happen, more guns, more laws, fewer laws, same government, different government, it doesn't matter. Whatever comes across our way, we can and we will survive and thrive as people of God. If not in the flesh, then certainly in the spirit. because we have chosen to walk by faith. We are willing to wait for His justice. And we will not grow discouraged when we do not see enough of our justice in the short term. Point number two. Or almost point number two, sorry. His will, not our satisfaction, is a priority. Let me touch on that before we move on. What's the most important thing in your life? I was just talking to Tracy about the myth of priorities that our good friend Chris Emerson mentioned on his podcast a while back. I may get an entire sermon out of this. I don't want to spoil too much of it here, but there's no such thing as priorities. There's only priority. The priority is the most important thing. How can you have more than one most important thing? Most important thing is Jesus, right? The most important thing is the kingdom. We're told that any number of times. Matthew 6, verse 33, et cetera, et cetera. Seek first His kingdom and His righteousness. And also seek first, now, another way it works. You seek first one thing, and then God will take care of the rest of it. We have to have enough faith to believe that by God working His will in our lives and in our culture, we will draw closer to His vision, His reality. We'll be better off spiritually. I believe we'll be better off physically too, but that's a side point. The main thing is that you and I can grow in our faith, and in so doing, grow in our connection to one another and our connection to God's plan for our life. If we will prioritize His will for our life and not simply how you feel about the given situation at any given moment. All right, that being said, let's move on. Let's talk about solutions. What's going wrong in your life? We're not talking about culture at large now. We're talking about you personally. What's your fix? What's your remedy? What's ailing you, and how do you get from point A to point B? Again, it's a matter of whether you trust in God, whether you accept His solutions. It very well may be that a person who has no faith in God, has no concept of God, who thinks that he is on this on his own or her own, the only way they can possibly fix their life is to do something drastic. Something that would previously have been thought unthinkable. You know, I used to watch Law and Order back in the day. You know, and I think I've commented on this before, how it seems like every week it was the same thing. By the end of the hour, the district attorney is staring at this guy who's just destroyed. He's just tearing his hair out across the table. And saying, I didn't think it was going to get this far. I didn't mean it to happen this way. Things got out of control because he made a bad decision, which led him to another bad decision, which led him to killing this person. And then he maybe had to kill somebody else to cover that up. It didn't start out that way. But he had a problem to fix. And he didn't see any way out of it. And when you allow violence to be a possibility, before too long, violence becomes a reality. God requires us to live our lives in His way. And part of that is by making good decisions as much as we can. And when we make a poor decision, we try to learn from that so that ideally we'd make fewer poor decisions in the future and maybe encourage other people to make fewer poor decisions as well. Part of that learning process is consequences. Part of that learning process is realizing how bad these bad decisions are. You know, the child steals the ice cream cone, and mom says, you shouldn't have done that. He says, you're right, I shouldn't have done that. Okay, well, I'm glad we're settled on that. And the kid goes back to eating ice cream. Well, what's happened? Has the child been emboldened to say no to stealing ice cream in the future or stealing other things? No, probably not. There were no consequences. In fact, things went perfectly well. God's plan is very different than that. And oftentimes, when we make mistakes, when our mistakes are pointed out to us as was the case with David in 2 Samuel chapter 12, remember, when he was caught in his sin with Bathsheba, etc. Oh, he lost his child because of this. And eventually, he's going to have great struggles in his kingdom also. David didn't become sorry later on. He was sorry then. Genuinely sorry, I believe. A lot of people aren't. I believe David was. And yet, God required him to pay for poor decisions. See, up to that point, David had been living faithlessly, at least in this particular chapter of his life. He didn't want to kill Uriah. Didn't start out that way, did it? And nevertheless, that's where he got. That's where we get. When we do not believe in God's plan, when we do not believe that we have to go through this process, that consequences for mistakes are not necessarily bad things, they're not necessarily things to be avoided. When we convince ourselves that God is not a part of the picture, all of a sudden all that we're dealing with is our consequences. And they're horrible. And suddenly we see a window of opportunity. Hey, maybe if I do this, I won't have to suffer. I've found my solution. Well, God's already given you a solution. And you didn't care for that. Now you found your own solution. And nobody's going to get hurt. We'll just tell a few lies. I'll bring Uriah home for the weekend. He'll go shack up with his wife, and nobody will be the wiser. Nobody's hurt. Well, it didn't work out that way. Well, now what are we going to do? Well, we'll try it again. Well, that didn't work either. Well, I guess we'll have to kill him. I would like to think it would take a little bit longer for you and me to get to that point. But I'll tell you, the more you reject God as the ultimate provider of solutions, the more you reject the idea that God is watching over your life and guiding you along the way and taking you to a better moral and spiritual place, the more you push back against that, the more likely, the more reasonable sinful situations and even violent solutions become. Is it really so surprising that in a culture that rejects God by and large, even the religious people of our society, in large measure, disconnect from seeing God as an everyday, hour by hour, arbiter of what is right and wrong, what's good and bad? Is it so surprising that violence becomes a reasonable and even a necessary solution? This goes all the way back to the kindergarten playground. He punched me first. Mom and dad teach you, hopefully, that's not a solution. That's not what God wants you to do. I don't think you have to be very old to understand that. But maybe you're not taught that. Maybe you're taught give as you're getting. Violence is the solution. And before too long, we're talking about abortion. I got myself into this mess. How can I get out of it? Well, you can kill your baby. You can do that. I do your own research on videos and blogs and such as to what is involved in that. I'm not going to get into that in this context. Maybe we'll another time. But it's gruesome what mothers will do to their own children because of their own mistakes. Because, and sometimes it's not even their mistakes. Sometimes it's other people's mistakes. I understand that. But how does violence become a solution? How does murder become a solution? Or suicide? When does it become acceptable to react violently simply to solve a perceived problem in our life? Sin is the problem ultimately. And we as people of God, hopefully we understand that. Whatever is going on in your life, whatever problems you're having, financial problems, personal problems, social problems, whatever it is, I hope and trust that you agree with me on this, that your biggest problem is sin. And I'm not calling you just a horrible, horrible sinner worse than anybody else, worse than me. That's not my point. Regardless of what your sin state is, sin is your biggest problem. And it's ridiculous for a person of faith to see sin as a solution. Sin is not the solution. Sin is the problem. Again, hopefully we as children of God maybe need to be reminded every once in a while, but hopefully we appreciate this as people of faith. If you don't have faith, this doesn't apply. We've been wasting the last 20 minutes if you don't have faith. God calls us to hope. God calls us to something bigger than this. To believe that whatever your circumstance in life, something better is coming. And I'm not talking here, I trust you understand, I'll say it anyway. I trust you understand. I'm not talking about the sun will come up tomorrow. I'm not talking about any philosophy here. The sun may very well come up tomorrow and make your problem even worse. I hope and pray that it doesn't. Whatever your problem happens to be, we all have them. God does not assure you that the difficulties that you're dealing with, the hardships that you're dealing with, will evaporate in a reasonable amount of time. They may or may not. You can certainly pray over something like that and hope that they get better. But that is not our hope. That is not the one hope of our calling that Paul talks about in Ephesians chapter 4. If you had one hope, and the Bible says you do, if you had one hope, what would that one hope be? My one hope would be that my boss finally get off my back. Really? That's your hope? My hope is that my kids go to college and graduate. Well, okay, that's nice. My hope is that so-and-so gets elected and so-and-so gets kicked out. You're aiming too low, folks. My hope is heaven. And there's no room in the heart of a Christian for any other hope than that. We believe that whatever is going on in this life, whatever is right or wrong with the world, whatever is right or wrong with us, that greater things are coming to us. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 talks about this extensively. I'll refer you to verse number 19 here. If we have hoped in Christ in this life only, we are of all men most to be pitied. You've heard that verse any number of times probably, right? Think about that for a second. Where is your hope? Is your hope here in this life? If only I could get another digit on my paycheck, we'd all be good. If only we could have kids, or if only we could get rid of the kids we already got, or whatever your hope happens to be. If that's it, you're devoting your life to Jesus so you can get a better education, so you have more friends, more money. Your life is a joke. You're the most ridiculous people on earth if that's the case, Paul says. We owe ourselves more than that. We owe ourselves a greater hope than that. We have to believe that the circumstances of this life, the hardships, the difficulties, the pain, this is temporary. And not temporary in the sense that it will only last for a day or a week or a month or a year. Temporary in the sense that it will only last in this life. Maybe not for all of it, but maybe for all of it. Difficult to say. Depends. Paul says in Romans chapter 8, verse number 18 and following, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us." It's not in the same ballpark here. You're having to put up with some pain and hardship and difficulties and sickness and such for 100 years and then go to heaven afterward? I'll take that deal. If you appreciate heaven, if you appreciate spiritual things, if you have faith, if you believe what the Bible says on the subject, surely you will take that deal. No matter how bad it is in this life. The anxious longing of the creation waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. We are the creation. We are suffering. We were supposed to suffer to a certain degree, going all the way back to the Garden of Eden. Your life isn't perfect. whose life ever was perfect. I only know of two people, and they messed it up as quick as they could. Ever since then, we're dealing with imperfection. We're dealing with hardships, problems that do not present obvious solutions oftentimes. And sometimes the solutions that do present themselves are hideous. They are sinful, even violent. If we put our hope in heaven, if we put our hope in spiritual things beyond this plane, beyond this world, then we can endure. We can find the strength. I know you don't want to anymore, and I want to, but you can, and you will. God will give you the strength to do it. There is no other hope that is worth your time and energy. If you didn't believe in God, if you didn't believe in heaven, that'd be a different story. I'm trusting in this context, in this room, that you believe. If you believe in the eternal soul, if you believe in God of heaven, if you believe in judgment to come, if you believe in eternal reward and eternal punishment, then what sense does it make to spend any time at all dwelling on these other hopes? Paul writes to the Christians there in Thessalonica, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse number 13 and following, 13 and 14. But we do not want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who are asleep, so that you will not grieve as do the rest, notice this, who have no hope. You can deal with life, you can deal with hardship, you can deal with difficulty the way that people out there in the world do. The ones who have no, you can do that if you want to. Why would you want to? They have no hope. Why should you act like you have no hope? For we believe, he says in verse 14, if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep in Jesus. This is our hope. This is our confidence. And by hope, we're talking about the typical Bible hope, where you are having confidence, and not like you buy a $5 lottery ticket and you hope you become a millionaire. That's not the kind of hope we're talking about here. This is an expectation, a confidence. God is going to take care of me. God is going to reward me in due course of time. My faith builds my hope. My hope emboldens my faith. And with this in mind, you might have a decent idea where the third one's going to go, by the way, if you know 1 Corinthians 13. If we can dig deep into faith, if we can dig deep into hope, we can find an assurance. We can find confidence. We can find a reason to live in a world that is not all that livable from time to time. I'm out of time. I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to pick up here, God willing, tonight. In the meantime, let's sing about how this world is not our home. Let's sing about how we are hoping for something else. Let's sing about how we have confidence that this ugliness, this pain, this suffering, this injustice that we put up with every single day, and we find increasingly difficult to do so, is not going to be the rule forever. Not because of how great we are, but because of how great our God is and how great His promise is. If you are a person of faith, then you can sing this song with confidence and with hope. If you're not a Christian, if you have not yet made heaven your home, if you have not yet made Jesus your Savior, this is a great opportunity for you to change that. It's a great opportunity for you to put your confidence in Him, put your hope in Him. Not so that the world will get to be a better place, but so that you will get to get out of this world and go to a better place. And in the meantime, serve God with everything that you have and everything that you are. Live a life of faith and hope and confidence as you wait for greater things. If there's anything we can do to help you walk with Christ more perfectly, please respond while we stand and sing to encourage you.